You're listening to Wolves Potluck.
And hey, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here today with an author chat with Yoshikuna Sakara, who joins us to talk about her debut mystery novel, The Midnight Taxi. Books and Boba, of course, is supported as always by our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba and become an official member. Our Patreon supporters gain access to our members-only Discord server where you can chat with us and fellow book club members in real time about all sorts of topics, including our monthly book club picks. And if you join us at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats, as well as the opportunity to help us pick a quarterly Patron's Choice Book Club pick.
Yeah, so we had a great time talking to Yosha about the criminal legal system and all its traumatic bureaucracy against defendants. We talk about Sri Lankan American culture and New York City. It was a very enlightening conversation. Also, we talk about true crime and the genre. So I hope you guys enjoy this conversation. And we are here with Yoshikuna Sakara, a Sri Lankan American attorney who represents people who have spent decades behind bars for crimes they did not commit. She teaches a course at Princeton University focused on wrongful convictions and exoneration. She is a former Manhattan public defender and currently an attorney with the Innocence Project. And we are here to talk about her debut novel, The Midnight Taxi. Welcome to the show, Yosha.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So I like to start our episodes with a little bit of an icebreaker. So since your book is a murder mystery, and you do mention a couple of fictional detectives in your book, do you have a favorite fictional detective?
Oh, gosh, that's a hard question. I mean, I really think about the classics. Of course, I love, like, you know, Hercule Poirot and Agatha Christie. I grew up with that. I really like the detective in The Verifiers by Jane Peck. I think that she's not a traditional detective, but she is extremely compelling. So I think I would go with probably those two. One. You know, old school detective and one more modern detective.
Yeah. In your book, you mentioned like Columbo and Benoit Blanc from the Knives Out series. And it just like reminded me of like a previous conversation Marvin and I had. Like he had mentioned Columbo and I was like, who? What? Like it's missing from like my pop culture knowledge. And yeah, I just feel like every generation has their own like champion for like murder mysteries.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that I have a little bit of old lady taste. So like, I love like Murder, She Wrote. I love Columbo. Like, those are the shows that I was watching, you know, with my parents growing up. And a lot of people don't get those references, which I think is funny because it was such a normal part of my childhood and really fun. So,
but also they're like formative texts if you're into mystery, right? Because without Columbo, you wouldn't get a Benoit Blanc or Knives Out, right? Because, you know, the whole thing with a Columbo mystery is you know who committed the murder and you spend the episode trying to figure out how does Columbo prove it. And I think it's really cool that there's a lineage of murder mystery from like classic puzzle box murder mysteries to like gritty noir mysteries to now the mystery that you wrote.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think these detectives are just kind of evolving as we go on. And I think it's any detective novel is taking inspiration from detectives of the past and then, you know, making it more modern and giving it its own spin. So I definitely have been influenced from the many detective novels that I've read over the years.
And it just goes to show that murder has always been in vogue. Like murder has always been a hot topic in pop culture. But we'll get around to that, the genre of crime and true crime. But as I mentioned in your earlier introduction, you are a lawyer. And you're not the first lawyer turned author we've had on this show. And surprisingly, most of them had dreams of being a writer from a very young age. And they were drawn to storytelling. And sometimes it's the parents who are like, find something more stable. Or in the rare case, you know, they discover writing in the later part of their career. So I'm curious as to what led you to like make that transition from lawyer to novelist.
Yeah, I always loved writing as a kid. I loved reading as a kid. My parents really encouraged both of them. I loved to do creative writing. But I think as I got older, I just began to talk myself out of that as something viable for me. I, you know, was telling myself all sorts of stories of like, you know, I'm not good enough to be a novelist and I have to pursue a traditional career. And, you know, as a lawyer, like I'm a logical person, you know, other people are artists and I'm not a creative person. So I really bought into this narrative that writing wasn't for me. And there were signs that like I should keep trying and I kept ignoring them. In law school, I took a novel writing for lawyers class.
There's a class for that. That's very specific.
It was very specific. It was with one of my favorite professors who actually wrote novels, but was also like a very esteemed law professor who actually is still teaching at the law school and still writing fiction. And he was very encouraging, but I still felt like, gosh, it's such a daunting prospect. And then you can write a whole novel and then to get it sold is just like so impossible. And so I really put those dreams away. But again, it kept these ideas for novel writing just kept percolating. And then when I would have a little bit of free time, like when I was a public defender, you do have some downtime while you're like waiting for your case to be called in court or you're in jail and you can't bring your cell phone in. So you like have this client file that you've already poured through 10 times over and then a yellow pad. And I would sort of scribble things down. And it was just using such a different part of my brain. And there was something like very fun about just being able to make up stuff. Because like in the law, like you really have to look at case law and you have to be very precise and specific. And I felt like this was almost like a diary entry. And at the time wasn't planning on anybody, you know, reading or seeing this. And then it did kind of just morph into a novel. And so it was, I don't want to say it's accidental, because at some point I definitely started carving out time early in the morning to start writing, but there wasn't necessarily like the intentionality behind it that I think some other people had.
So when you were journaling during your downtime, were you like, was there a specific genre you returned to? Was it all murder mystery or were you doing like romance, fantasy, sci-fi? Like what sort of stories came to mind as you were waiting in that courtroom?
Well, my husband always says that I need to have a hobby outside of murder, but I really don't. I mean, my job right now, I have a bunch of murder cases. I write about murder. I teach about murder. And frankly, I, you know, never really thought I would write anything. I think the most out of the genre was like, it was a thriller. Like I had been writing some like literary thriller stuff, but it was still someone still got murdered in like everything that I was writing. And so I didn't veer away too far. And I think I just was writing what I loved to read. And I love mystery and thrillers. I love books where I'm guessing the ending. I mean, that's what's keeping me up, you know, much later than I should be up. Page turning is just those like propelling and propulsive plots. So I wrote really what I like to read. So
was The Midnight Taxi your first manuscript, or did you have another manuscript in the drawer before that?
It was not my first. I have written a few full-length novels. Most of them have never, all but one, have never seen the light of day because I was like, this wasn't good enough. But it was such a good lesson in like learning the craft. And so I don't regret that at all. I did have one prior manuscript that, you know, with a different agent that went on sub and nothing happened. And so that was like really a crushing experience because I felt like I poured my heart and my soul into it. It was like a kind of darker legal thriller, very different than The Midnight Taxi in some ways, but also some similar themes about the criminal legal system in other ways. And so when that didn't work out, I was feeling extremely demoralized. And I was, again, had the thought, I was like, oh, I was right. I'm not supposed to be a writer. Like the same kind of naysaying voice that I had, you know, to that point, I felt like I'd confirmed that. But again, I mean, there was something just so soothing and relaxing about writing that I, again, began to write and, you know, got the Midnight Taxi. And, you know, thanks to the encouragement of very patient and loving friends and family, you know, continued to write and edit it with the hopes that maybe I would be lucky enough for it to see the light of day sometime.
Yeah, I think lawyers in general, they have to face so many obstacles. And I feel like there is a grit, there is a resilience that is very similar to the kind that writers need in order to get published. So I think you were really primed to become a novelist.
Yeah. And I think that grit extends also to like the editing of work. Like I don't feel precious about my work. Like, of course, I work really hard and I'm very passionate about what I write. But one of the biggest gifts to me is like developmental agents, developmental editors, people who are like, you know, even my sister who has read everything I've written since I was a kid. She's 10 years older than me, also a lawyer and a far better writer. And everyone was like, this is the stuff that needs to be changed. And so I think when you can go in with that thick skin, ultimately you get, you know, a better product. And I think even like that's the rejections. It's like the rejections are hard, but like sometimes you'll get really lucky and an agent who rejects you when you're trying to get representation will tell you like, this is what didn't work with the book. And like, to me, that's like a total gift. And I think also as like a public defender and, you know, Innocence Project attorney, we get told no all the time. Like we're quite literally like fighting the system. And so I think you're right. Like I've developed a thick skin in that, you know, if I don't get a yes at the first juncture, I have to keep going because for my job, I don't really have a choice. I have somebody who, you know, at my present job is innocent for a crime they didn't commit. And it's, you know, I can't be so easily dissuaded when, you know, I have the responsibility of trying to seek their freedom.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like that grit really paid off because your debut novel is coming out this week. If you're, for those of you listening to our podcast next week, for us here recording the week before, but yeah, congratulations on getting The Midnight Taxi over that finish line. I guess for our listeners who aren't familiar with your book, can you give us a brief, like, you know, pitch of what Midnight Taxi is all about?
Absolutely. So The Midnight Taxi follows New York City Sri Lankan American taxi cab driver Siriwathi Pereira as she picks up a passenger late one night. And when she gets to his destination, he's been murdered. So it's this classic locked cab mystery. She must travel across all five boroughs of New York City with her public defender, Amaya, in search of clues to, you know, make sure that she doesn't go to prison for the rest of her life. And it's, she only has a matter of days in order to, you know, make sure that she's not sent back to jail. So it really is a love story to service workers, to immigrants. And, you know, New York City really is a character in the book. And my love of New York City is, you know, spread throughout the book, but it also addresses a lot of serious issues in the criminal legal system, I hope in an accessible way to readers.
Yeah, like what I found really fascinating about the premise of your book is, like you said, it's a locked room mystery, but the room in this case is a taxi, a locked taxi cab mystery. And it's like so fresh to me. It's like a fresh twist to the locked room mystery. How did you come up with the idea? Like, what inspired you to, you know, write a murder that takes place in a locked taxi?
You know, I was thinking a lot about taxi cab drivers. There was one event where I was leaving something called Night Court, which is where I was representing New Yorkers accused of crimes. It was late and I saw a yellow cab that was waiting outside of the courthouse to take people home. And, you know, I got in and the cab driver specifically waited there to pick up lawyers to hear about what happened in Night Court and was like so interested in true crime. And we had this just moment of human connection that you really don't have a lot in New York City because everyone's rushing to get to their next place. And it just got me thinking about taxi cab drivers. And then I started to see them, you know, truly everywhere. The taxi cab stands where they're filled with, you know, drivers who look like me, who are going to restaurants late at night or getting, you know, a cup of chai to fuel a late night of driving. And at the same time, I was dating my now husband, whose father was a taxi cab driver and whose grandfather was a taxi cab driver who actually got shot in the head and lived to tell the tale and then also went back to taxi cab driving. So it was all of this. So I was very interested with this like aspect of focusing on like a service industry that is so often overlooked. And that was kind of where I got the idea. And then I thought, you know, why not have the murder take place in a taxi cab? I mean, where are taxi cab drivers spending most of their waking hours within, you know, their cab driving around? And so that's really how that the idea came to me.
Yeah, I was actually pretty surprised that your main character was a woman cab driver because it's so rare in New York City. So what made you decide to make your protagonist a Sri Lankan American immigrant woman who happens to drive a New York City yellow cab?
So the secret story behind that is that I actually originally had the main character as a man. And so there was a different interplay between the taxi cab driver and his public defender. But, you know, when Berkeley was thinking about buying the book, they were wondering, would I be open to changing the main character to a female POV? And I thought about it and I agreed. And I think ultimately it made the book much more me and much more compelling than it was before, which again, this is like I always say, be open to edits. And so I changed the whole book and it's so much more obviously than just changing, you know, pronouns. You're changing a lot of the story, the interactions between the characters. And I think the book became so much stronger for that change. And then I wanted her to be Sri Lankan American because I, you know, I'm Sri Lankan American and I never saw Sri Lankan American characters in mysteries. And I just think representation is important. And it's just really a love story to my culture in so many different ways, through food, through family. And I wanted to, you know, prove to myself and, you know, maybe my parents that, you know, people are interested in our stories. I think, you know, my parents are first generation immigrants who were, you know, quite literally told to go back to their own country. And so, you know, while they, you know, had dreams of like something like this happening, they were very skeptical that people would be interested in our stories. And so the fact that I was able to write something that is so authentically about our culture and that someone, you know, a publishing house bought it is just has been like a really special and gratifying experience.
Yeah, I really loved in that first chapter when Siri meets Amaya Her, who eventually becomes her public defender, and they have this instant connection because of that shared culture. And I was like, that, I feel like that's just something you don't understand until you, unless you are like a minority in a country and you find someone who can like even connect you on a base cultural level. That's a really special thing.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think there's, I think specifically, like, you don't meet a lot of other Sri Lankans. And it's just, you know, we all oftentimes get lumped in with the rest of South Asia. And there are a lot of similarities, but we're also like a very distinct culture. And we have a very, we have a large population of us here in New York City, especially on Staten Island. And so I just wanted to highlight that. Like, it felt like it would be the excitement that I would get on the chance meeting of somebody else who is Sri Lankan, because even if we are, like, you know, coming from totally different backgrounds and histories, or just like certain things that you connect with and you like totally get. And it's just like, you know, it's like a very familiar feeling. And it's just so rare to have that I really wanted to capture that their special connection early on.
Yeah. Too bad those good vibes are immediately spoiled in the next chapter when a murder happens in the back seat. I will say, when I was reading that chapter, like, I knew it was coming because of the premise of the book. So I was paying extra attention to like where you left like little breadcrumbs on where this murder might have happened. But, you know, your main character is essentially falsely accused by the state for the murder that happened in her cab. And you go into great detail what it's like to be processed through the system, you know, from being booked to lockup. Was it important for you to make sure that these details were documented?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I really draw on my years as a criminal defense attorney, because I wanted people to see how the system works. I think a lot of people get these idealized versions of what happens when someone gets arrested, that people's rights are always honored, that, you know, the criminal legal system always gets the right person. And it's really like, that just isn't the case. And I think like a lot of stigma and assumptions happen when you've been arrested of a crime, even if you're innocent until proven guilty. And so I wanted to really capture the fear that Siri had and just like the kind of isolation throughout this process. And of course, like, it is a work of fiction, so there are portions where you have to suspend disbelief, but that booking process is, you know, it is what happens. Like, those cells behind the courthouse are where people wait to be heard by a judge who may not be completely paying attention to their case. And, you know, bail is a very real part of the criminal legal system. And so I just wanted to highlight all of that to just take somebody who may not normally learn about the system and teach it in a way that's like not so preachy, but also furthers the plot.
I have to say, like, the first 30, 40 pages, I was so stressed. I was like, oh my God, what a terrible position to be in. How traumatizing. And I feel like a lot of true crime documentaries and also like shows like Law and Order, I feel like they really gloss over that trauma for the defendant, because a lot of the times in these shows and in these documentaries, we're looking at it from like a cop's point of view. So we don't really get to see like kind of the abuse that the defendant goes through in the booking process.
Yeah, that's totally right. I mean, especially with TV shows, like, and I grew up watching them. And I think that's partially why, like, Siri loves true crime and, like, Law and Order, because that was me before law school. Like, I really thought it was entertaining. I was rooting for the, like, bad guy to get caught. And, like, the defense attorney was always some, like, really disheveled person with, like, a mustard stain and a missing button, clearly doing something, like, super illegal and shady. And we just bought into this narrative that, like, the defense is evil and people who are charged in the system are horrible. And I really wanted to challenge that. With that said, I think true crime is nuanced. I think there's a lot of true crime that perpetuates a lot of truths or you know, shines a light on a lot of issues in the system that people need to know about. And so I think there can be a lot of power in like social media and documentaries that talk about, you know, the ills in the criminal legal system. But I think there is a particular way to go about it. And I think it can be hard to balance like the entertainment value of true crime, because you know, when HBO wants you to watch the documentaries or whatever, whatever streaming service wants you to watch it. So they want to, there is the need to create like a compelling narrative, but, you know, there's varying degrees of success as to whether people are actually presenting it in like a fair and helpful light. So I think it's, I tried to present that as well in the novel. Like in many ways, Siri does have helpful tips from her true crime that are, you know, further the plot along and make her a better investigator. But in other ways, she's like totally realizes that there's a lot of things that she has gotten wrong because just watching true crime documentaries doesn't, you know, make her a lawyer.
Yeah, it is interesting that like a lot of like the most compelling true crime series are essentially structured like murder mysteries, right? You have red herrings, you have leads that go nowhere, you have like twists and turns.
Yeah, I think in some ways there's podcasts out there who are like highlighting cases of people who have been wrongfully convicted. And those cases are interesting. They are meandering. There are red herrings. And especially when an innocent person is convicted, there's usually a like very interesting story there. And so I think there's a lot of podcasts who give a lot of media attention to cases that desperately deserve it. A lot of people, once you've been convicted, it's like pretty miraculous to get post-conviction relief. So in that sense, I think true crime can be really, really positive and spotlight, you know, very vulnerable people who desperately need, you know, attention on their cases. But I think at the same time, a lot of times true crime will, as you said, Marvin, like will focus on, you know, one person to the exclusion of everybody else. And then the police stop doing their job and stop investigating. And it's just like, you know, we just make assumptions. You've been arrested. The police went to arrest you if you're innocent. And it really creates this false narrative that I think is pretty dangerous. And it's not only, you know, terrible for the person who's been accused of the crime, but it's really harmful to the victims who have already, you know, faced loss and have already been, you know, the recipient of, you know, horrible things. And then again, they're not getting justice because, you know, various actors in the criminal legal system aren't doing their job. So it just benefits no one.
I think a lot of your readers will be surprised by how much of a disadvantage the defense team has when it comes to the investigation. I mean, Amaya and Siri, they have a very short window to investigate before the grand jury, and they're not even given the victim's name. Like, they have to figure that out through sleuthing. And I thought that, like that disadvantage made planning the murder mystery in your book, like, even fresher. So can you, like, tell us, like, how your character's disadvantage as, like, a defense team help you plan the trajectory of their investigation and like how they would gather clues?
Yeah, I mean, at the heart of the mystery is one party having an information disadvantage. And so the way the legal system works in reality actually was a good like stomping ground for that, for lack of a better word, because you really don't get a lot of information. You get, you know, when someone's arraigned, you get like sometimes a paragraph of what they're alleged to have done and no evidence that the, you know, the prosecution is going to use against them. And legally, they don't have to give that up until, you know, weeks later. But then the problem is, of course, the grand jury, which happens very, very quickly. And so, like, that definitely propelled Siri and Amaya to start investigating immediately. And it also is, like, when the evidence is the most fresh. I mean, you know, surveillance tapes get taped over within 24 hours. So it really created a realistic, you know, view of what it is to actually be an attorney investigating a case, because you really do like immediately have to send an investigator out. That's not fictionalized to create tension in the book. You really do. There is a law that says, you know, grand juries can happen as soon as like 6 days, but it's from the arrest. So because she was in the precinct for so long, there's even less time. And so it's all grounded in like the reality of how things work. And it really is, I mean, it's a stressful situation in real life for all of us public defenders too, who are, you know, desperately trying to figure out next steps in our clients' cases.
Yeah, I really liked how you structured your mystery around like the bureaucratic systems of our justice system, like the grand jury being the deadline to find the real killer. I think, it really did. Not only did I learn a lot about how everything works, but also adds to the tension. And I thought that was really well done.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's like you had an outline already to like work with. It's like, oh, time crunch. And like, this is where all the stakes are going up. Like, I feel like it's like the perfect blueprint to work with in order to like outline your story.
Yeah. Speaking of outlines, I always like to ask our murder mystery authors this question, which is like, how do you construct your mystery as you're writing it, right? Like, are you the type of mystery writer who is able to, you know, create, you know, the root of the investigation as you write along, like chronologically, or are you the type of person who needs like an outline, right? Do you have like a red string board connecting all the different suspects and evidence and red herrings? Like, what's your process in building a murder mystery?
I mean, I absolutely should have had one of those red string boards, because I thought that I was like, I can make this up as I go. I can tie up every loose ending. And I got to tell you, my first couple drafts, frankly, riddled with plot holes. Certain plots were not tied up. People were guessing the ending. I mean, it was a true disaster. And to those authors who can just create a whole complex murder mystery in their head, like, you're amazing. I have learned that is not me. And I had to unfortunately learn it the hard way, because I did not do an outline. I now have long outlines, because there's just so many. I get it, because I'm a reader too. I want twists and turns. I don't want to guess the ending. But if you want to create something super complex, there are a lot of different elements. And it just, you know, and because you're so in it when you're writing, you can think that you've resolved something, and it's gone by the wayside. So now I am like religious, detailed outliner, and it makes writing like so much easier, and I can write so much faster.
Did you know like the solution to your locked cab mystery before you wrote it?
I sort of did, but then I changed it because people were like, it was a little too, people were guessing it. So then I was like, okay, I have to add. So I added a lot of twists and turns as I continued to draft the book. So I sort of did, but then I kind of changed the ending, because again, it was, you know, I didn't, some of the feedback from like the very, very early readers, like we're talking draft one of like 15, draft two of 15, were like, oh yeah, you know, I had a feeling it was this person. And I was like, no, that's the worst thing. So yeah, I sort of did, but then I had to change it because of poor planning on my part.
So not only is Amaya an under-resourced and overworked public defender, she is a brown woman in a field dominated by privileged white men. And you, as someone who worked as a public defender, and as someone who is Sri Lankan, American, and a woman, I'm sure your gender and race affected how you navigated your job. And we kind of see that with Amaya, but can you tell our readers a little bit more about like how her gender and race affect the way she does her job, and also affects the way that she and Siri work together in the investigation?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Amaya feels like she has so much to prove to herself, to her peers, to her clients. I mean, she's already representing people who are disadvantaged. When you say public defender, a lot of people have a lot of negative connotation. So, you know, even if she was coming in with so much privilege, she still would be disadvantaged, but she's not coming in with privilege, and she's very aware of that. And she never wants her personal identity to be a disadvantage for her clients. And that's definitely, you know, how I felt as a public defender, where, you know, you could tell that some clients would, not because, you know, they had anything against me, but they wanted the best possible. They were facing, you know, like freedom or, you know, incarceration. And they wanted someone who the court would take seriously. And historically, the law has been relegated to, you know, white men. And so that's definitely part of like Amaya's kind of tough exterior. Like, I can do anything anybody else can. And I think at times it comes off as the fact that she has like a really hard edge when, you know, as the book goes on, you really do discover she does have this like sensitive side that Siri also has. So even though initially like both the characters appear to be like total foils and total opposites, I think they do have a lot in common when you kind of scratch get below the surface, you know? And so I think that my personal experiences being a woman of color in court and seeing how I was treated differently from my other colleagues certainly, you know, played a huge part in how I crafted Amaya.
Yeah, I found it really interesting that like throughout the investigation, Amaya would like switch her tone of voice because she's a woman. She can't come off as like too aggressive, and she can also like not be a doormat. So there's like this balance that she's playing. And it's like it's very interesting to see her like use her femininity as also like a tool for getting justice.
Yeah. I mean, when you investigate cases, people react to certain things, and you can say, well, I'm gonna always be, you know, who I am 100% of the time, but that might be to the disadvantage of your client. And so oftentimes, you know, and I think you also have to understand that people, you know, feel a lot of fear when there's some stranger knocks on your door being like, hey, tell me more about a murder, is like a little disconcerting. And so you do have to kind of adjust your temperament for the good of the client. But again, that's something that probably women have to do more than men, you know? And that's one of the, you know, commentaries I wanted to make and why it's been really wonderful to have the book led by like two really strong, powerful women, because I think it does show how, you know, they have to work that much harder. They have to, you know, kind of shape shift that much more in order to get what they need. And it's not, you know, it's not right, but they feel as if they don't have a choice. And so that's, you know, that kind of changing of voice, that kind of changing of character to fit the situation is a product of that.
Yeah. And also their investigation leads them to different parts of New York City, and each borough of New York City has their own personality, and you have to like deal with that. And I think you describe like the quirks of each neighborhood that they visit in New York City really well. And it kind of reminded me of Jane Peck's book, The Verifiers, because like her book also takes place in New York, and it's also like a cyclist. So there's like transportation like involved. So I want to ask, like, do you have a favorite neighborhood in New York City? Is there like a borough that you're like, that's me, they represent me, like totally for them?
I mean, there's so many parts of New York City that I love. I mean, I currently live in Brooklyn. I love Brooklyn. It's so diverse. There's so many good food options. But I also really, I love Queens. Like, if I lived in Jackson Heights, Queens, I would never use my kitchen again. Like, there's just too many good restaurants. And it's like, you can get an incredible meal for $10, which is just like amazing. And I think there's just the reason I wanted to do all five boroughs is because there is so much culture in each borough that people don't realize. I mean, I get the draw of like Midtown and, you know, Broadway and Times Square, but like if I can convince even like one person to back away from the Times Square Applebee's and like try a good pizza place in Brooklyn, or even, you know, like you don't even have to go outside of Manhattan. Like Chinatown is like so near and dear to me because it is right by the criminal courthouse, and for night court, like 9 p.m. you're heading to, like, I was always, if I was in the night court shift, I was like, I always had a list of like, here's where I want to go. Like, this is my favorite dim sum place. We got to go here. We, you know, I want noodles tonight. Let's go here. I want Vietnamese. Like, let's go here. And it's just like, it's not even that far from the heart of, you know, the quote unquote heart of Manhattan, if you're saying that's Times Square. And I just wanted to introduce people to like, all of these amazing things that New York City is that, frankly, I didn't even realize until I lived here. Because like everybody else, I was sticking around, you know, Madison Square Garden, because that's where my Amtrak and hotel were. And so I just, it really is like a love story to New York City, and especially the amazing food scene that we're blessed with.
Yeah, like the only way I would go to the other boroughs when I was living in New York at the time was food. I'm like, okay, we need to go to somewhere that serves like the best immigrant food, because otherwise I will not take the train. I will not go the distance. So totally understandable with like New York having such a rich food scene. Although, you know, Marvin and I are from, we're LA residents. So we have to say that our food scene is better than New York. So
it's different. I wouldn't say better, different.
I don't know. I say better, but
ooh, fighting words.
I will say New York City has a better restaurant scene. And I feel like with LA, we're like much more sprawled out. And there's like a lot more smaller businesses that I think really have like honed their craft in making one specific thing that is just really, really good.
I feel like as like, you know, I'm old enough to like not want to get caught up in who's better, who's not. We're all, everyone's good at what they do. And that's, you know, everywhere has something, everywhere has good stuff. And I just love finding the
good
stuff.
I'm not saying that New York doesn't have good stuff. I'm just saying, like, I mean, it's different. And I guess like my preference says that I like the LA food scene better. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, I mean, your book is definitely also a love story to immigrant communities. There's this one quote that I'm sure I'm remembering wrong, but it's when Siri finds out that her bail has been paid, and she mentions that, like, my community is rich, but not in money. And I thought that was just really, like, you do a really good job, you know, depicting the communities. And, you know, I especially love how Siri's parents especially are, you know, they're trying their best, and they show up as they can. And it was really great to see that they were on Siri's side throughout the story.
Yeah, I mean, they absolutely love her. And I think that for Siri, it's not always in the ways she wants or expects. And I think she projects a lot of that as being, you know, the second born, you know, girl. And I think, you know, there is so much prestige for the eldest child, especially if the eldest child is a boy. And so I think she's just trying to navigate that. And I think she is in some ways projecting, like she feels like she hasn't done enough. And so she projects that. And she's like, my parents must be really disappointed. And I think also sometimes, you know, immigrant parents don't always have the best tools to communicate their love for their children. And so I think sometimes their silence or their inability to communicate that way makes Siri feel like, okay, they love me less, or they're not proud of me, or I'm like screwing things up. And I think like immigrant families like my own, I mean, they're beautiful, and but they're also complicated and complex. And there's just so many things happening that I just really wanted to capture that. But at the end of the day, like her parents love her more than anything, and she loves them. And the way they communicate that is, you know, oftentimes less than perfect, just like, you know, many of our families.
I think you also depict like that, like older 20s, like early 30s anxiety about like your parents' mortality. And it's like, okay, like I will have to take care of my parents, but like I can barely take care of myself. And, you know, like, Siri is a cab driver, and that's not the most prestigious job. And, you know, of course, like you said, she is projecting a lot. It's like, oh, I'm not as successful. How am I supposed to take care of my parents? And of course, like she also has an older brother who is kind of like the golden child. So there's an extra layer of pressure for her to perform.
Yeah. Absolutely. And she definitely like feels that stress. She wants to take care of her parents, and she wants to be the person that they can rely on. But at the same time, she like resents it a little bit. So it's this complex interplay of, you know, I'm the kid, and I still have to, you know, have all these obligations, but also this guilt where she's like, I have to take care of my parents, and it's, you know, it's required of me. And I think that's partially why she becomes a cab driver, not necessarily because that was her dream job. I mean, she wanted to become a lawyer, but because like they had a taxicab medallion in the family and like that, you know, those are really expensive. And so they basically had to have somebody drive in the family to not lose money and to be able to, it was, you know, it's one of the, for her family, she thought the one of the easiest ways to, you know, kind of make money. So I think those relationships are just, you know, forever complicated. And I just wanted to, you know, really focus in on that because it really just, she doesn't want to be away from them, but she also wants to be away from them. And it's just like this tension of like, she doesn't want to be in her childhood bedroom, but she also doesn't necessarily want to live on her own. And so it's this like complicated narrative of like, where is she going to end up?
Yeah. Speaking of like the taxicab medallions, I had no idea like about that and how much money it costs and like how it does get passed down. And you said earlier that like her husband's family, you know, they have cabbies, and I'm just interested in like what were some details about that life that you were surprised to learn?
Yeah, I think the details were just how dangerous it was historically to be a cab driver. I think, you know, now cabs, and because like ride shares just feel like a way of life, like we just kind of, we never think, you know, that there is like an inherent danger to the drivers. You just kind of get in, you get to the destination. I hadn't really been thinking about it, but especially, you know, New York in like the 70s, 80s, and early 90s, you know, cab drivers were often getting robbed at gunpoint, and you just never knew what you were going to get when you pick someone up. It's not like they have a star rating and, you know, you can see, you know, some, you know, you can evaluate who's going to get into your cab. And so I think just like the fact that, and now I think that danger has morphed itself into like when COVID happened. I mean, part of me thinking about and writing this book was over the COVID times and the dangers that like cab drivers confronted with their health, or the fact that they weren't working because there wasn't enough people taking cabs, and that kind of living, you know, day to day without knowing when your next paycheck is going to come. So I think that that was like such a nuanced understanding of like what cab drivers were going through. And I think like they've also, you know, continued to have to fight very hard to get rid of debt associated with the medallions. And that's one of the things that our new, you know, New York City mayor had been doing prior to becoming mayor. I mean, I believe he like staged a multi-day hunger strike on behalf of taxi cab drivers to deal with a lot of the debt that they were accruing, because there was a number of taxi cab drivers who were, you know, committing suicide. It was horrible. And so I think it's just, again, I it's one of the reasons I wanted to focus on cab drivers, because they are such an overlooked in group of people in the service industry. And I think that they do such essential work, especially when it's, you know, late at night and you don't want to take the subway, or the subway isn't running properly. And it's really just, I wanted to, you know, explore those issues in a way that felt a little bit more light.
Yeah. And like the fact that Siri is also like a woman cab driver, I'm like, oh my God, like as a woman who takes Uber or Lyft, like I kind of have like that panic of, am I going to get killed during this ride? Like I share my GPS location with my husband and with my friends whenever I have to take ride share. So I can only imagine how much scarier it is if you're the driver, you don't know who you're picking up. You have to deal like at least with the passenger. It's like, okay, I just need to get a ride. You only meet the driver once. Whereas like on the other side, it's like you're meeting a lot of people and they might be crazy and you're a woman. So there's also that added danger.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's definitely an added danger as a woman. And I think even for like Amaya, there is a danger in like investigating cases and having to go knock on doors. Like they're both in their own ways putting, you know, their safety, like, you know, entering into someone's house that you don't know to get an interview because they may be involved in one of your murder cases is also scary. And so I think both of them really have to, are exercising like a level of fearlessness that the situation like demands of them.
Yeah, and yeah, that tension is present throughout the entire, like, even from the moment that Siri gets arrested in Good's process through their investigations, that sense of danger is always in the background, especially because someone may or may not be following them throughout the book as well.
Yeah, yeah. Like, the fear of someone stalking you in the streets of New York, that is definitely something that every female New Yorker has gone through. So, like, we're towards the end of our interview, and when we read the arc, we noticed that the first three chapters of your next book was included. So is there anything that you can share with us about your sequel?
I am so thrilled that there is going to be a sequel. Berkeley bought my first two books, so I have been working away on that sequel. It is, you know, you're going to see some familiar characters. You are going to have New York City as a character as well again, but in a different way. There's going to be a lot of secret history of New York City. So it's going to be a side of New York City that many people don't see, which has always fascinated me. Parts of the city that are hidden, literally and figuratively underground. And then also you're going to still see, you know, themes on social justice issues, because that's really important that my mysteries carry some sort of message. And so, yeah, I'm super excited. I just got my draft in a couple weeks ago, because I'm actually 9 months pregnant, and so my first draft was due the day before my due date. So I was like, well, I need to definitely get it in before then, because, you know, I've heard babies don't always come on time. So the draft is in. I'm sure there'll be a ton of edits, but it's just, I'm so excited to, you know, be able to relive these characters, but with a fresh, new, twisty mystery. And so I really hope, again, I keep readers guessing, I keep readers, you know, turning the page, entertained, but also, well, maybe learning something.
Yeah, I'm very excited that the adventures of Siri Amaya will continue. I'm looking forward to, like, a whole series of this, like, Sri Lankan Perry Mason Paul Drake relationship going on.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, I mean, Siri is definitely an old soul, so she loves all those old-timey detectives. Amaya is, like, you know, a little more Gen Z and is a little more hip, so they will definitely have that dynamic again in book two.
Yeah.
Well, I can't wait to read it. So thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us, Yosha.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been so fun.
And that was our conversation with Yosha Gunasekera. Her debut novel, The Midnight Taxi, will be available at bookstores everywhere on February 10th, including, as always, the Books and Boba Bookshop, where all purchases support us here at Books and Boba, as well as your local bookstores. So if you're interested in picking up the book, head on over to booksandboba.com and check out our bookshop link. All right, before we call it an episode, Rira, can you remind us what book we are reading this month for Book Club?
Okay, so our February 2026 book club pick is Zen Cho's Behind Frenemy Lines. Is a rivals to lovers contemporary romance, and it is about two lawyers who begrudgingly share an office and their mutual nemeses to each other, and then they have to pretend date. So lots of familiar romance tropes in this one. This was actually Marvin's pick. Surprisingly, because it's a romance.
I mean, I feel like I always pick, when I do get the February pick, I pick a romance just because it is the love month. And, you know, I am not against reading about love, and especially if it's written by Zen Cho, who wrote one of my favorite love adjacent stories, Sorcerer to the Crown, which was like a Regency era magical fantasy romance taking place in, like,
that was like our second, third book.
It was very early on, but still one of the books that I recommend to anyone who will listen, because I really very much enjoyed that book. So I'm really excited to see her writing in a more contemporary setting. And so far has not disappointed. So I'm really looking forward to discussing this book with you at the end of the month. And if you have been reading along with us, please let us know your thoughts on Discord, where the book club is already having a very lively discussion on this romantic comedy. But yeah. With that, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Hungry for spicy food and even hotter conversations? Craving community and authentic storytelling? Then join the table. This is Minor Legends, a new comedy fiction podcast supported by Potluck. Pull up every week with me, Angela Wong Carbone, and follow the stories of me and my friends as we serve up tasty tales of what it means to be Asian American at our weekly dinner hang. If you enjoy deep dishing on absurd stereotypes like tiger moms who tutor your dating game rather than grades, the insanity of your parents' immigration story, to the legend of that one good Asian cousin you can never live up to, then pull up a seat and grab a plate. Featuring dinner guests like Ronnie Chang, Brian Park, Usama Siddiqui, Celia Au, Perry Young, Supriya Ganesh, and more. It's a tasty rotation that'll leave you belly laughing and steeped in relatable and spicy conversations. Can you take the heat? Listen now for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, sports fans. Welcome to Asians in Hockey. You may not realize it, but there's a rich history of Asians and AAPI folks who have contributed to the legacy of the greatest game on ice. From classic legends like Julie Chu and Robin Bawa, to current greats like Lia Lum and Nick Suzuki, and even rising stars like Akane Shiga and Jason Robertson. We'll cover their stories, celebrate their accomplishments, and learn about their impact on the sport of hockey. I'm Nate Nakao, former Beer League player, occasional youth hockey coach, and longtime hockey fan, and I'll be your host as we take a look at the rise of Asians in hockey. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.